Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for the first Nationwide Language Access webinar. My name is Laureen Laglagaren, and I am a policy analyst here at the Migration Policy Institute's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, and I will be your moderator for the next 60 minutes. Before we begin the formal presentation, I wanted to give you a very brief overview of our webinar features and talk briefly about MPI's involvement in language access. First, logistics. We sent out the underlying documents referred to in this presentation yesterday. Please call 202-266-1929 if you did not receive them. Otherwise, you can email me after the call and I will send you the documents. During the formal presentation, you will be able to ask questions by chat function. Simply enter your question and hit return. So I'm going to appear as Lisa Dixon, but here, I'll give an example. So everyone will be able to see your question, but we will not answer the questions until the question and answer period. It'll just allow me to keep track of all the questions as the presentation moves on. During the question and answer period, you may also ask voice questions by pressing star one. So if you do that, we will identify you and unmute your line in order for you to ask a question. We have over 90 people on this call today, so I'll have to be fairly strict with time and questions. However, we will keep the line open for questions or follow-up comments past 4 p.m. if you would like to stay on. If you do have burning questions, I will compile key questions and, with the help of our presenters, distribute formal question and answers based on this call offline in a few weeks' time. So here is our agenda for the next 60 minutes. First of all, I wanted to begin by telling you a little bit about the Migration Policy Institute. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan, independent think tank based here in Washington, D.C., devoted to the study of migration. We analyze, develop, and evaluate migration and refugee policies at the local, state, national, and international level. And the program that I work for, the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, is one of five program areas within MPI. As a policy analyst here, I study immigrant integration, which we define as the social and economic inclusion of immigrants. We view this as a two-way process where not only immigrants adapt to their new communities, but communities themselves adapt to their new immigrant neighbors. Which brings us to the topic of language access and the ways governments provide services to limited English proficient clients. This is our first nationwide call on language access. And with over 100 people on the line, it can get a little bit tricky. So just to give you a little bit of history behind this call evolved from a working group of state and local language access practitioners brought together by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. MPI's involvement in the area of language access began with our relationship with the Casey Foundation when it found that their working group members were having a difficult time exchanging resources, for example, translated documents, sample RFPs or contracts, and bilingual testing materials. Through our center, we were able to launch the language portal in February of this year with the support of contributions from KC Network staff as well as the support of the KC Foundation. And this is a snapshot of what the language portal looks like. It's a digital library of over 600 resources relating to the use of language access services in the area of social service and public safety. It includes legal guidelines, service models, master contracts for service providers, hourly translation and interpretation rates for different languages, pay differentials, all sorts of really neat and useful topics for every state that we could find. And it was really created to provide one-stop shopping for state and local government officials involved in language access. So our goal here, our job here actually at MPI is to serve as the intermediary between the Casey Foundation and the network of state and local language access practitioners. We view our main job here is to help state and local government agencies strengthen their quality of practice in the provision of translation and interpretation services. And we've got three components to our work. One is to maintain and expand the language portal. Two is to promote and support evaluation of the impact of language access services. And the third, which is part of what we're doing today, is to provide you, the practitioner, with avenues of communication, consultation, and learning opportunities. We also have formal training programs in the works, and if this webinar is helpful to you, we hope to continue to provide language access webinars targeted to state and local language access practitioners. This, as I have said before, is our first experiment, and as such, there may be bumps along the way, but we certainly welcome any future topic suggestions, or if you would like to become involved in organizing future calls, please feel free to email me. First off, I wanted to thank a couple people who made this call possible. First, the faculty who helped me plan this call, Kleber from New York City, Wanda from San Francisco, Vinny from Minnesota, Jason, who will be on this call, and Mark as well from New York City. In thinking about what would be helpful to you, we decided to discuss two topics, one dealing with the nitty-gritty aspects of language access provision, and another topic focused on language access policy. As you will note, we do not have a lot of time to go into the details of each topic. Instead, our goal is to give you the highlights of each presentation, discuss common challenges and opportunities, and connect you with the policy expert in that particular field. Contact information will be available for each speaker. I'd also like to thank the speakers themselves for making their time available to us this afternoon and for taking on the unenviable task of whittling down their very interesting perspective and presentation into 5- and 10-minute increments. And finally, I want to thank the Annie E. Casey Foundation for making this call possible. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Jason Reed. I will refrain from reading you speaker bios, which you will be able to read online. Jason?
Thank you. And I want to thank MPI for putting this call together. I think these will be really helpful discussions. I work for a large state agency in Washington State, the Department of Social Health Services, and we've been kind of dabbling in language access services for over 25 years and had a fairly comprehensive program for about 15 years. And one of the things that I first wanted to identify as a framework for our discussion today is that there are three core components to an effective language access program, those being available and timely services, and secondly, quality of services, which may include clear and accurate sentence or messages, and also a means for using qualified language access providers. And thirdly, that the program would need to be cost effective, and especially these days as we see ourselves in every state and discipline district needs to be aware of economic situations. So now, taking those three things into consideration, out of all the three, out of all the possible resources and methods for providing language access services, those would include contractors, volunteers, or any types of technology. We in our state have determined that the best way to achieve timely, accurate, cost-effective language access services has been through the use of qualified bilingual and multilingual staff, and with emphasis on the qualified piece, which we're going to be talking about today. So with that said, I've put together a set of slides that give a general overview of the agency's bilingual employee program. I'm going to focus my comments on how we determine the qualifications of bilingual employees in our agency. And in interest of time, I'm going to go ahead and skip over a few of the slides here, and we can come back to those during the Q&A, or we can address them offline. So the first couple of slides, I'll scroll through those quickly here, just talk about the factors that we use in considering that you should use and when considering whether or not to use bilingual staff. The other slide has to do with determining how you will use bilingual employees. And this requires a discussion about whether the bilingual employee will be used to provide services directly to an LEP client or whether you're going to use them as a third-party interpreter or translator. And so these first two slides basically provide a framework for what goes into developing a strategy for assessing bilingual employee skills. I'm going to go on to the next slide, which talks about establishing a standard. And here, just a couple of examples of informal ways of doing this, reviewing the candidate's resume, looking at things like education in English and non-English languages, experience in working with limited English proficient persons, looking at their certifications that they may have. Another method may be to conduct a portion of the interview for the position in the non-English language that you need. My agency has chosen to develop its own formal testing process, and it's worth noting that that was somewhat of a result of a legal mandate that was provided on us. So, but an overview of our testing system is actually provided in a handout that, or a document that was sent out prior to the conference. The areas that are that the examination manual focuses on are listed at the bottom of this particular slide. Just wanted to make a quick note about test development. There is a tremendous amount of time and effort and resources that go into test development, and many of those are mentioned in the examination manual. And this slide here just talks about those. If we want to go to one of the other things that was sent out was a document. It's called Bilingual Employee Test Information. And this was also sent out prior to the conference here. This provides information about our actual test, what our test is made up of. There is actually a written exercise and an oral exercise. The written exercise is comprised of five different portions. Two of them are multiple choice, three of them are actually written exercises. The multiple choice exercises there's examples that are listed in that handout. The three written exercises are comprised of a written test, or what we call a writing test, which is a non-English language summarization exercise. We give the candidate a piece of text in their language, and we ask them to put it in writing or summarize in writing what's being said in that paragraph. And then there's also two exercises, one going for translation, one going from English to non-English, and the other from non-English to English. The oral exercise is made up of a sight translation. We give a piece of paper to the candidate with text on it. We ask them to orally render that into the target language. And then there's also consecutive interpretation exercise, which is a recorded conversation between an LEP client and a worker, and it's played to the candidate, and the candidate verbally renders the message they hear into the other language. Also included with that handout was a listing of our positions that we have in our state agency and what type of tests we would give them for their language skills. Just a quick note about training. It's important to focus on developing and fully utilizing the existing staff resources that you have already available. That may require some prior to testing, shoring up their skills, or maybe if they've taken the test and haven't been successful, to assist them with that, increasing their skills in a training, some type of training. The next slide, I'm going to skip over the next couple of slides that deal with caseload assignment, how we go about assigning caseload to our bilingual workers. And we also the next slide here is the incentive pay or assignment pay, some different options. We actually pay a salary increase of about 5% to all of our staff. This last slide here, it talks about our draft policy, and that was another one of the handouts that was given prior to the conference. That particular document provides an overview of our bilingual employee policy. It covers the worker's eligibility, our hiring process for bilingual staff, the testing requirements that we have for the staff, and what we expect the bilingual employee to do. And kind of along those lines of the role of the bilingual employee, it's important to note that there is a difference between simply having somebody being bilingual and providing services directly to the candidate or the clients versus functioning as that third-party interpreter translator. And so it's necessary to use different exercises or skills assessments for those two different types of skills. And so with that, sorry to run through that so quickly.
No, that's great. It was just a very good snapshot of the issues involved. And it seems from the chat function we have our first question, which is from Jada Charlie. She would like to know more about test development in terms of the actual development process. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about the history of why you developed a test in the first place.
Yeah, just with what happened was back in the early 80s, the Office for Civil Rights, did some audits in our offices and determined that we weren't providing equal access to services to clients. And that was based on the Civil Rights Act of 1964, that we needed to do that. It was determined that we, as part of the hiring process, we have people indicate whether or not they are bilingual, and if they indicate that they're bilingual, we were simply accepting that as truth. And so we ran into some problems with people that had taken some high school Spanish, for example, and simply weren't qualified to be functioning as a bilingual employee. So it was determined, and this is through legal mandate, that we would establish a formal program. And based on that program, we have been able to, identify individuals that have the skills to do this and some of the, weed out individuals that don't have the skills. As far as test development, there's a section in the examination manual that kind of talks about the steps that we go through to develop a test. But a lot of that has to do with things like assessing what the person's doing on the job. We do desk audits. We go about looking at the different materials that particular program generates, like their publications and forms, those types of things. And we also take a look at whether or not the position actually needs oral or verbal skills. And so I don't know if that answers the question there, but that's...
Sure. And if you have any voice questions that you want to ask, please hit *1 and we can take a voice question. Right now, we were wondering, was there any union involvement in establishing differential pay?
Yes, there was. That was a major part of, we actually... involved them very much in this, and there's been continuing discussion with them about how we move forward with this. There's been some discussion because some positions require oral skills and some require written skills and some require both. And for that purpose, we've actually talked about having incentive pay for just having one set of skills versus another, and the union's been involved in those discussions.
Great. And Gerald from Hawaii asks how large your agency is and your staff and what type of staff do you have? Does the pay differential apply to bilingual staff who are also used as third-party interpreters?
So our agency, we're approximately 18,000 staff. We cover a wide range of services from child protective services. I work in the welfare branch of the department that does eligibility for cash, food, and medical assistance. We also have work with alcohol and substance abuse, mental health issues, and disability termination services, developmental disabilities, long-term care services. So we're a very large state agency in Washington state government that covers all those services. And the incentive pay does go apply to bilingual staff who are also used as third-party interpreters. And just a note on that, we initially, when we started a program, it was back in the early 90s when we really started focusing on this, we were using employees a lot more as interpreters at that time, which is kind of why we have the test made up. I noticed there was another question about that, the way we have them made up right now, but we're moving in the direction of using them as direct service providers rather than interpreters. And there's some reasons for that, that just in general, interpreters are required to be non-biased. And so if you're using an employee for another employee and a client, that may at least give some resemblance of the interpreter not functioning independently or neutrally for both sides if they're an employee of the department. So there's that. And then there's also issues with regard to, staff being over-abused, I guess, being tapped on the shoulder 3 and 4 times a day to be that interpreter in the office. And even though they're being compensated for using their bilingual skills, it's not compensation for additional workload. So, and they have to drop their work to go and interpret for somebody else. So we started moving in this direction of just having that person work within their own caseload and provide that service directly.
Right. And I think we have our question.
This will be Rose Trujillo.
Rose Trujillo, if you wanted to ask your question, you're unmuted now.
Okay. I wanted to find out whether you've come across any problems in your certifying languages with different language dialects.
We have. And there's a big discussion, particularly in the Spanish language, where there are so many different countries that speak Spanish. That's always been a kind of a hot topic for us. And we wouldn't necessarily refer to those as dialects. We considered the Spanish language to be just one language. And what we've tended to do is focus the test using terminology that's referred to as broadcast Spanish, which is the type of Spanish that would be used, on Univision or other general broadcasts, television broadcasts or newspapers that are world newspapers. Focus on that type of language. We do actually have a test when we talk about dialects for Chinese. We have one for Mandarin and Cantonese. So those are kind of, the things that we've considered. But like I said, Spanish is always a difficult issue. We have a very large population of migrant workers that move here from Mexico. Some of the people that participated in the development of this test were from South America. And there was, we've actually modified some of the language from the time it was initially done to better mirror the clients that we're serving. So.
And Jason, is there an ethics component to the testing?
There's just a real brief ethics. There are 10 multiple choice questions on it that ask basically true-false questions about ethics, and that's the extent that we go into with the test. And it's very difficult to test a person's ethics. They can answer all those questions completely accurately and be unethical, but that's how we handle that. And we also have a code of professional conduct that we require of all individuals that provide language services in our department.
And I know that there was a clarification question earlier, sight translation versus simultaneous interpretation, is that the same?
No. So the sight translation is again, an exercise that we basically give written text to a candidate. They orally render that into the target language, and we audio-record that, and we bring it back to our office, and we evaluate it. The consecutive interpretation is essentially that, where there will be a conversation between the client who's non-English and the worker who's English. We play that conversation with pauses between each sentence or phrase for the person to interpret. And so that's consecutive. And then the simultaneous, which is one of the exercises we give to our contractors, is basically they're interpreting at the same time that they're hearing the source language.
Right. And Du Kaneshiro earlier on asked, the oral tests appear to test for interpreter skills. Is that needed for employees who will not be interpreting but will instead be providing direct services in the second language?
It technically is not. And so that's one of the things we're looking at here is looking at possibly doing more of a focusing more on a written test that does a better measurement of a person's bilingual skills rather than going through some type of interpretation exercise. And however, again, the test was developed with that in mind when it started, when we were using employees more as interpreters, but we're moving, again, in the direction of not doing that as much anymore.
And do your outside third-party interpreters, translators, also need to take the exam? Who needs to take the exam?
They take a completely separate test that we give to contractors. We have testing for interpreters as well as for translators, and it's a separate test that carries fees, and we require our contractors, we contract with language agencies that provide our services in our field offices, we require them to use only people that have been certified, whether through our program or some other language assessment program.
And do you have accompanying glossaries for the programs and the languages used to serve the LEP population?
We do have some that are fairly outdated. They were done about 15 years ago. And actually one of the projects we're working on this year is looking at revising those. Obviously, even at the federal level, we've changed some of the terminology that we use when it comes to assistance programs. And so part of that exercise is to weed out the old terminology, put in new terminology, and do a comprehensive review of that. But we do have that currently available in 7 languages.
Great. And then our final question for this series, also from Du. Can you elaborate on what is covered in the ethics test? Does it focus on the role of the bilingual employee rather than the role of an interpreter?
It would focus more so on the role of the interpreter.
Okay. And since that was a quick answer, I'll ask one, our final question. Do you permit clients to use family or friends for interpretation if that is the client's preference? If so, under what circumstances?
Our policy is that we don't, and that person, that client can, you know, bring in basically whoever they want, whether that's an advocate or a family member or friend, but we will utilize, as far as interpreters, a neutral third party there to, you know, assist with making sure that things are being said correctly between both parties.
Great. Thank you so much, Jason. Very, very useful to find out what's happening in Washington State. And we're going to move quickly on to our second speaker, Changhua Hong. And I'm not going to read her bio, which you will be able to see on your screen now. Changhua?
Hi, Lorraine. Thank you so much. I'm the executive director at the New York Immigration Coalition. I'm really pleased to be part of this briefing. I want to thank the Mayor's Office of Operations and the Mayor's Office for Immigrant Affairs. And we have ACS on the call, so I want to thank Mark, our next speaker, and, of course, the mayor for getting us what we think is the most comprehensive language access executive order in the country. So I wanted to talk first about what's in it. I think everybody should have the document, the actual executive order document. I'm sorry, I didn't do the PowerPoint slides. So what's in it is basically 5 big components. One is the requirements include translation of key public documents. Second, interpretation of at least in top 6 languages. Third, posting of visible signs about rights to interpretation and translation at all agencies. Fourth, every agency is required to appoint a language access coordinator. And fifth, they must use plain language. And so those are the major requirements. The executive order also has both in the order itself and the process, the guidance that followed articulates, you know, how people are going to, how agencies will meet those requirements. One, that agencies will have flexibility in determining their language access plan. And second, at the same time as having that flexibility, that they must meet certain standards defined by, in New York City's case, customer service group, which I'll talk about later. And then there's kind of a template that's provided to each agency as they develop their language access plan, which they're required to develop by January 1st of next year, that they're asked to have 9 components to consider. One is the agency mission and background, and to set language access goals. Third, do an assessment of the language limited English proficient population. Fourth, implementation plan logistics. Service provision plan, a training plan, a record keeping and evaluation plan, public awareness strategy, and resource analysis and planning. So that's the broad outlines. I want to talk about what makes our particular executive order so special, because I really think it has parts of it that are really just ingenious and very could be a good model for other cities. First is that the whole language access policy is placed under the mayor's Office of Operations customer service group initiative. And so it's a joint effort by operations and immigrant affairs. I don't think I have to explain why immigrant affairs is involved, but the part about operations is pretty interesting because having it part of the customer service group initiative ensures implementation because it gets integrated into existing citywide priority and infrastructure. For instance, the customer service group was already mandated to, number one, to improve customer service experience, and then two, to improve customer response coordination. And so with this language access executive order, we were adding language access as part of that. And so as part of that structure, they have 4 subcommittees that are looking at walk-in centers and how language access is provided at walk-in centers, through call centers, through online service. And those are the 3 major ways that we're looking at language access. And then the final point about implementation is that there's real accountability here because as part of the operations, it's tracked through the annual mayor's management report. So it's part of the overall agency's assessment. A couple of things that I wanted to note also in addition to kind of the structure is that the executive order really balances the several competing components, which is it balances kind of hard requirements with specific standards. With flexibility for agencies, and I think it's really important to have those 3 components in a balanced sort of way. Another thing that the city did was they did a secret shopping kind of secret assessment. They sent in people, guys, as customers to see how things are right now and to test various components of customer service, and language access ended up coming out with the lowest rating, 1.9 out of 4. So it just gives agencies a sense of, you know, how big the gap is in order to get to a place post language access executive order. And then I think it's also great to include the plain language requirement in the language access because bad language in English is bad. It's hard to understand in other languages. And then with New York's experience, this really was a culmination of 10 years of language access advocacy work, and we were able to do the citywide policy because for several years we had made huge progress on other huge agencies. For instance, our first language access legislation that was passed into law was with HRA, the Human Resources Administration, so with the Medicaid Center. So it started out with language access for major public benefits like Medicaid and food stamps. And then we did language access with hospitals. This is through mostly state regulations. And then Department of Education, I know Cleaver Palma is on the line, who's heading up the DOE Translation and Interpretation Unit. So we had already done these model policies through chancellor's regulations or state regulations or city legislation at big agencies. And so it was natural to lead up to a citywide policy. And then I think one of the, I want to end, and the next point is one of the most important components of why this was possible was the work of the mayor's office on immigrant affairs, both the Commissioner Guillermo Linares and then former deputy commissioner Ozzie Kalingli is just kind of a leading national expert on language access. And what she did was created a interagency language access task force. And so she had, I think she had a couple of dozen agencies working together, and she provided a set of trainings and technical assistance and policy backup to get the process started and get the buy-in of agencies over a certain period of time so that when the citywide policy was happening, that the mayor already had, you know, support from most of the big agencies. And the final point I'll make is that this was a really great example of community government partnership, because the entire process was only possible because of the very intentional consultation with community groups. From the beginning, the mayor's office began with having a community roundtable to look at priority issues in immigrant communities, and language access emerged as one of the big priorities. And then there's a whole kind of another story to be told about what our advocacy kind of grassroots strategy was, but I'm not going to get into that other than to just mention that it involved, you know, lawsuits, doing countless reports, and doing very kind of bottom-up monitoring and legislative campaigns that all kind of fed into the culmination of this citywide language access executive order.
Great. Thank you so much, Chenghua. And for someone who is living under the executive order, why don't we turn to Mark Lewis next?
Thank you. I'm really glad to be invited to be part of this. So for full disclosure, I want to start by saying that prior to coming to the Administration for Children's Services, I used to work with the New York Immigration Coalition as their lobbyist. So the first lesson is to be careful what you ask for, because if it's a much different challenge to try to implement something through in a large agency than to complain and to push agencies to do the right thing. I also apologize, I don't have a picture of me. I thought this was an online dating service, so I figured if you send me your picture, I'll send you my picture. But that's the last joke. What I want to talk about today are three challenges, basically, that I think agencies have in implementing executive orders such as Executive Order 120. First is the issue of having the responsibility to implement a far-reaching policy without the authority. The second issue is the issue of budgetary constraints combined with agency priority constraints and how those two dovetail together. And the third is the challenge of implementing language access policy with a policy that has a lot of flexibility built in, and the challenge of making sure that the language access program that you implement doesn't just comply with the technical requirements of the policy, but actually provides true equal access to all limited English proficient clients. So on the point of responsibility without authority, I think those of us who are in language access, we know the critical importance of it, and we think that everything should revolve around language access. I think from a large agency perspective, language access doesn't really drive the agency. It's not viewed like a computer system. All of us in government, we couldn't imagine operating without a computer system, but I think most agencies would look at language access as more of a support service and not as a mission-critical piece. So I think most language access coordinators are usually within a division within a large agency. Most don't report directly to the commissioner, so there's a lot of responsibility, but we don't have the direct authority to require the different divisions to implement and to train staff the way we would want to do that. The second issue is budgetary constraints and priority constraints. We have a significant infrastructure built into our agency in terms of interpreter services and translation contracts. I think full implementation in the optimal way, we're going to need new budgetary add-ons, and in this environment, that's going to be extremely difficult. So this executive order really didn't come with a pot of money for agencies to tap into, and we really need to look within the agency to do that. So that's a challenge. But the other challenge also is, all of our agencies, there are many different things going on, and in order to really implement, to implement language access policies, we really need full cooperation of all the different parts of the agency, and that means making this a priority within the division, within each of the divisions. So at Children's Services, where we do child protective investigations, the question is for us, do we do training for our child protective staff in terms of identifying risk factors to ensure that no child is hurt? Or do we pull staff out of their jobs to be trained on language access? So those are difficult. So those priority constraints really make implementing language access policy challenging. The third piece is flexibility, and Chung-Wa was talking about how flexibility was built in. And that's a positive thing for our agencies, but sometimes a little flexibility can also mean that we sometimes more requirements can be helpful to an agency in implementing language access policies. So some of the issues that come up, and I think it is very positive that there are going to be certain management standards that are reported on, because what is counted and reported gets done. But we're working on implementing the language access policy before those standards are in place. So hopefully that will provide some greater guidance to us. But some of the issues that come up in terms of the flexibility and the dangers of flexibility are, we have the option of how many languages do we translate documents into and provide interpreting services to. So, we have clients who speak over 150 languages, and so in the best of all worlds, we would like to be able to ensure that key documents and notices are translated into all those languages, but we're not going to be able to do that. So we have to pick and choose what languages we actually do translate for. The whole issue of the type of interpretive services, we can be in technical compliance with the law by just having a telephonic interpreting system, but we know that that's not the optimal, and we also want to combine that with contract interpreters, more bilingual staff. But there is a danger that in a year without much money, that you end up doing the minimum as opposed to what really would make true language access policy. One of the other issues that's really challenging for our agency is what documents to translate. The executive order talks about essential public documents, but that's a fairly ambiguous term, so that's something that we have to grapple with. And that issue is also difficult because many of the documents that we use are actually state documents. And I know my colleague Lynn and Mary from the state are on the call. So we really need cooperation from the state. Most of the state documents are only in English and Spanish, And our goal is to translate all these key documents into at least 9 languages, so we really need their cooperation. The plain language requirement is a fabulous requirement. From a language access coordinator perspective, it's difficult because the documents that we have that we need to translate are not in plain English. So I'm not sure that we can take on the challenge of translating complicated English documents into plain English before we translate it. So that's another issue. And then the last issue that I want to raise is monitoring and measurement. There's an expression that I learned a long time ago, is the juice worth the squeeze? So, you know, we're really faced with an issue of to really do the best monitoring and measurement of our language access, we really need to create new computer systems and new programs to really do that. And my challenge is to really convince the agency that we're going to get enough out of that to invest the resources in that, because there are other alternatives. We can do samples of cases to look at whether we're providing quality services. But so those are some of the challenges in terms of implementing the executive order. So I think I've gone over, so I will...
No, that's fine. Chung-Hua, did you want to retort or address any of the things that Mark mentioned before we take our first few questions?
No, I think he's exactly right about, I mean, I think there's a little bit of tension between what we had to do to get this done politically, which is, the flexibility that's built into it. And we knew that would, in the end, require heavier lifting by the language access coordinators and staff. But there is that little bit of a gap between what it took to get this done politically, and then within a lot of the challenges that Mark mentioned, or I think is a direct function of the budget environment, we actually did fight hard to try to attach some money to it, but it was just we decided to take it in phases because it was just not going to be possible to attach a specific dollar amount to it at this particular time.
Which actually brings up our first question on this issue on the current economic climate. How will it impact the implementation of the executive order? For example, will agencies be able to hire new language access coordinators in this economic environment?
Mark?
I think that's going to be mixed. I'm actually the language access coordinator, and I came on before based on the local law. I think most agencies will reach into their agencies and find people that can perform this. I think the question is whether these are full-time. In my mind, it really takes, it's a full-time job to develop and implement the language access policy. I think it's going to be mixed in terms of city agencies, in terms of how much of an investment of staff resources they put into it.
Great. Our second question, I was actually curious about this as well. Could you talk a little bit more about the testing program, the secret shopper program that you mentioned? Nicole Jassy, I'm not sure what state you're from, but she writes that we've been talking about trying to use testing without overstepping or jeopardizing our position as a legal aid organization. So if you have any more information about the secret shopper initiative in New York City, please do share.
Oh, I don't, because they haven't shared what the specific metrics was that they used. But I can tell you a little bit of that. Mark mentioned that the city is still developing the standards. Some of the hints, though, could be some of the standards that the customer service group already has is for walk-in facilities, it's wait times. So I'm sure there was something related to wait times. And then for call centers, the speed with which you answer calls. So how many of your calls were answered in 30 seconds or less, right? So I'm sure with calls, it's looking at, wait times. And then for online correspondences, you know, are the letters or correspondences answered within 10 to 14 days? Or are their internet, you know, requests responded to within a certain number of days? So these are the standards that they already have for existing customer service assessment. So I'm sure there are components of that that were used in testing, but we, you know, as was applicable to language access. And then I'm sure. So I don't know the exact. You know, I'm sure they look for indicators that are contained in the order, such as were the signs posted, interpretation, translation.
Right. Right. And I also know that Wisconsin's Health and Human Service Agency were thinking about employing mystery shoppers in their agency as well. But again, it runs into the financial restrictions of staffing that type of program. So, I'll certainly share it with the overall group if I find out anything more about secret shoppers.
We should try to get it from the they didn't make it available to us, the advocates, but maybe after they establish the standards, we might be able to get it.
Right. And just to remind people, if they want to do a voice question, you can just press *1. Question from Michelle Lerner. What is the system for providing interpreter services at administrative hearings in New York City, such as welfare, food stamp, or subsidized housing hearings?
Mark, do you know?
Well, my understanding is most of the fair hearings or administrative hearings for welfare are actually run by the state. And I do believe that they do provide interpreters for the hearings. What I'm not sure about is whether the hearing decisions are actually translated, and I tend to think not. There really is a whole issue in terms of legal documents and court orders where the policy has been that they should, that in New York at least, that they're English only, and that's an issue that we're looking into, because we do petitions to clients with allegations of abuse and neglect, and those are only in English, and the court system is resistant to actually translating them into other languages.
Great. And then we have another voice call from Michelle Lerner in New Jersey, and we've just unmuted you, so if you wanted to ask your question now, please.
It was just a follow-up in terms of you said that there are interpreters provided, but you don't think that the hearing decisions are translated. I was wondering where the interpreters come from. Part of the reason I'm asking, I've worked in legal services in both Massachusetts and New Jersey, and in Massachusetts, the state welfare agency has, and also the unemployment agency has a contract with Catholic Charities to provide interpreters, and I always took it as a given that interpreters at administrative hearings would be from a neutral third party. And when I got to New Jersey, I had to fight even to get an interpreter at welfare hearings, and then the welfare agency used their own caseworkers as interpreters, even though they were one of the parties. So I've been trying to look into how other jurisdictions handle this, and was just wondering what the system is for providing oral interpretation.
Yeah, I'm almost positive that the state uses interpreters through contract agencies. The state actually has a list of interpretation and translation companies that they have statewide contracts with that enable city agencies and not-for-profit agencies actually to access those contracts. But I'll try to clarify, and if I'm wrong, I'll let people know.
Thanks. How do I mute now?
We'll mute you. You're muted now. Mary Rosendorn asks, how does New York City's executive order differ from the executive order, the presidential executive order?
I don't have the national one in front of me, but one thing that's interesting to note is that there was a whole section from the federal one that was cut and pasted, basically imported into the city one, and it's that section in the middle that talks about the language access plan that each agency will develop will take into account the following four factors, the number of LEP persons eligible for service, the frequency with which the clients come into contact with the agency. Third, the importance of the benefit or service to the person. And the fourth, resources available to the agency. So that part was imported into the city part.
I think you can find the presidential, the executive order, the presidential order on the MPI language portal.
Good for you, Mark. I didn't even have to plug it myself.
I think if my memory serves me correct, I think the federal policy really talked more about meaningful access and was a little light on how that, what that actually meant. So I think the executive order puts some more clarity in terms of what does it really mean to have meaningful access by talking about, you know, what certain documents that need to be translated, certain number of languages that need to be translated, the posting of signage, things like that, are much more specific in the executive order.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Marcia Tamura asks a larger question, and for this, Jason, you may also want to chime in. Are there any tools used to help identify the language of the client for non-bilingual staff? In other words, how do non-bilingual staff identify which language interpreter to request?
Well, in my agency at Children's Services, and it's actually part of the state computer system, there is a primary language indicator that needs to be filled out. And interestingly, when I first got here, it defaulted to English. So if the worker didn't do anything, it showed up as English. And the state was cooperative and changed it, so it now defaults to blank. So at least you know if someone hasn't actually entered the data. But I think it's an important question in terms of how that primary language determination is made and whether clients have the right to say whether they want what language they want to speak in, or I think oftentimes workers decide how proficient the client is and whether or not they're proficient in English or not, whether they need interpreters.
Go ahead. There are examples of iSpeak cards, you know,
exactly.
iSpeak blank, that's available, samples from different agencies.
Of which those are also available on the portal if you wanted to check that out.
And then in Washington State, we require all of our field offices to have a poster. It's a point to the language poster. And we also have, in the past, have had flip charts at the front desk that will identify languages for clients if they do indeed read their own language. So.
Great. And Roberta asks, how are you addressing the provision of language services by agencies with which you contract to provide services?
That's a good question. The executive order actually is silent on that issue. And for my agency, we contract with preventive and foster care agencies to provide a lot of our services. And it's actually an issue that we're trying to address. And actually, we have a new RFP that has much stronger requirements for the contract agencies in terms of their language access requirements. But if I'm correct, I believe the executive order actually is silent on that issue.
Right. And we're also seeing not just contracting agencies, but a lot of the agencies have, for instance, security personnel, who just turn people away, like at the entrance. Those kinds of issues are coming up, and we did not include that. So I think that should be part of the implementation discussion.
And a follow-up question on the iSpeak cards. If someone calls in, how does a worker identify a different language if they don't know the language that the caller is speaking in?
We would connect them to language, our telephonic interpreting system, Language Line, that can help determine that. And I think in certain ways, for my agency, it's almost more efficient to do that, to determine languages that way than using the language cards, because oftentimes our workers don't carry, they don't carry around the language cards. So that's another way of determining language.
So I just want to alert people that it is now 4 p.m. I wanted to formally thank all of our speakers for a very lively discussion on language access. It's so great to talk to practitioners, and we've been very pleased with the format, but I'm going to display my contact information. So if you have any questions or comments about today's calls or ideas for future topics, certainly feel free to email me and or give me a call, and I'm more than happy to discuss. We'll stay on the line for a little bit longer to answer a few more questions, but I won't be offended if you leave our call now. So we had one question about, is the English proficiency rated by staff done subjectively, or do you have a template to follow, from Susan?
I'm not sure. When we determine if someone's proficient in English, is there a, how do we assess that? That's a good question. It's really a subjective by through our caseworkers, and one of the things that we've recognized is that we need to ensure that clients are able to have the right to say whether they want to have interpreters. The law, you know, it's a little strange because the law and the executive order talks about, or the local law 73 talks about limited English proficient persons have a right to interpreters. But it doesn't. But who is limited English proficient is not that well defined.
And
I don't know if I answered that.
I hope that she'll ask a follow-up question if you have not, or perhaps call in to ask the question. And another question asks, what have your agencies done in terms of Indigenous languages on iSpeak cards, or Indigenous languages in general, perhaps?
That's a real challenge. So one thing we actually did, we were having problems, the Mexican community in New York, many speak Mixteca or other Indigenous languages, not Spanish. So we actually contracted with a Mexican community-based organization to help us provide those languages. We were having difficulty getting that through contract agencies. But that really is a challenge, and that was the best way that we could address that is working with some community-based groups.
Right, or another challenge that's not included in the executive order is for populations with low literacy rates. So, you know, looking at kind of audiovisual ways instead of just the poster, you know, that has the written signage.
Right.
And in Washington State, Mark's kind of alluded to the fact that with regard to the indigenous languages, we've had much more success using telephone in both identifying the language and then also providing the service,
right,
because of the limited local resources that we have.
And Jason, I've got a question here for you from Mary Rosendorn. Who participated in the development of Washington State's bilingual employee test?
The University of Washington participated in some of the development aspects. There were language, the way that we do that is we obviously developed the test in English first. The person that was running the office at the time was a linguist by education, and so he developed the English test that way. It was reviewed by supervisors and because it's kind of broken up into different job classifications, and so we had supervisors review the English version of the test or the test in English, and also had the testing instrument itself reviewed by the University of Washington. And when the test was translated into the different languages, we also had groups of individuals get together and meet to talk about the translation and determine, make sure that it was accurate, those types of things.
And our final question is, how is New York City dealing with LEP clients who are sensory impaired?
By sensory impaired, we mean hearing and hearing to say people with hearing problems and visual?
I think so.
We use TTY for persons who are hearing impaired, and we also use interpreters for them, which is actually quite expensive. But you know, there are very strong ADA requirements on that, and we're hopefully in compliance. We should be.
Well, great. I wanted to thank you all again for participating in this call. I hope it will not be the last call. I will send out dates for our future call. My guess it will not be until early December. But again, do keep in touch. Send me an email to tell me what you think, or you can even do it in the chat function if you're already online. But thank you so much, and we'll talk again soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.